This is the Lean Discovery Applied podcast with Clinton Sanko, Baker Donaldson's e-discovery officer. In season one of Sitting with the C-Suite, Clinton and guests will explore the e-discovery industry's past, present, and future, largely through the eyes of the executives responsible for the technology and services underlying virtually every e-discovery project.
Hello, I'm Clinton Sanko, and welcome to the Lean Discovery series, Sitting with the C-Suite, where we are committed to unraveling e-discovery one interview at a time. Today, we are joined by Dr. David Lewis, the Chief Data Scientist of Brainspace. Please join me as I welcome Dave to the show.
Thank you, Clinton. It's great to be here.
So, Dave, why don't we start with you just filling our listeners in on a little bit about Brainspace, the company, and the services that you offer.
So we're a text analytics software company focused in the e-discovery investigation space and related areas. Also get into compliance, some law enforcement, some national security applications, and a few other text analytics areas.
So as I was preparing for today's interview, Dave, one of the things that really stood out to me was you're really coming at this as a true scientist and scholar. Looking at your background, you have a BA in mathematics, you have an MS and a PhD in computer science. I understand that you worked at Bell Labs. You were elected as a fellow to the American Association for the Advancement of Science for your work specifically on text classification. And looking even back to your dissertation, it covered the concept learning model, which I understand and I think you described in your thesis as a new theoretical model for text classification systems. Mm-hmm. In short, you're passionate about text classification. Yes. It's what you focused your career on. Yeah. And so I was curious, kind of out of the chute, there's so many different applications for what you do. In the business world to solve business problems, there's so many different places that you can take this and apply it. What was it that attracted you to the legal space specifically that you brought your talents to an e-discovery company in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I had worked in lots and lots of different text classification areas over the years when I was both at Bell Labs and then when I was a consultant for 16 years. I stumbled, like a lot of people, I stumbled into e-discovery, you know, through weird coincidences. That seems to be a theme in the area. I had been working as a consultant on an intelligence agency funded project on a search of scanned documents. And I was looking around for a big collection of scanned documents and ended up negotiating with University of California, San Francisco to get a copy of their archives from the tobacco litigations. And then through various circuitous things, this led me into designing a government evaluation of e-discovery technology using those documents, and then designing software for some of the e-discovery companies. As a consultant, a lot of consulting as an expert witness on e-discovery conflicts and litigations, including a couple of 10-figure cases. And then eventually I had been consulting for Brainspace, and they convinced me to hang up my shingle and come on full time. There's a bunch of things that have just kept me interested in the space. One is I enjoy working with attorneys. When I was a consultant, I did a lot of expert witness work, and I always enjoyed the fact that attorneys have their own formal system, like mathematics or science, but it's very different than science is. So just the going back and forth between those two formal systems is fascinating. Also, the adversarial character of the law means that issues like interpretability and evaluation of analytics, which have always been research interests of mine, loom larger than they do in, say, computational advertising, which is another area I worked in, where really all you care about is how much money, how many ads did people click on. Those things got me really interested, and then just the data is extremely diverse. If you look at the kind of stuff that gets collected in a litigation, it's every kind of thing that's on your laptop, on your phone, on your company's file shares and whatnot. So it's just extraordinary. You never run out of kind of interesting new complexity to the data. So those are all reasons that have kept me fascinated with the area.
As to the history of the company, I remember back in the day when it was introduced to the market, it was called Pure Discovery, and we used it in its very, very early form. But I understand that Dave Cox founded the company in 2006, and at that, you know, at one point he described it as three guys in a garage, which I always love those kind of startup and bootstrap stories into what they become. So Cox sells BrainSpace to Sixtera in mid-2017. And then in November of 2019, Sixtera, it spins out BrainSpace into a company called AppGate, which I think is now the parent company of BrainSpace that you work with. And AppGate, of course, is a security-focused company. I think they have a technology called AppGate SDP, which is a perimeter solution for security purposes. What effect has the transition into AppGate had on BrainSpace in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think if you asked our clients, you'd say it's had very little impact in the sense that we've always kept focused on the same technology, the same mission that we've always had. I think, except for it showing up in the news, I think you've probably seen very little impact on clients. What you have seen for us is some advantages in that, you know, in a mundane sense, we can draw on very good computer security people when we're, you know, when we have to deal with, making sure that the software is secure. There's been, not surprisingly, some, synergies there. I think particularly with respect to the federal government, for instance, because of the strength of the connections there. I think it's a sensible umbrella. You know, obviously, text analytics and investigations, particularly, is part of the whole sort of security space. So we fit pretty naturally with the kind of suite of security software and services that AppGate has.
You joined BrainSpace as chief data scientist in June of 2016. And it's always fun when you're doing these kind of interviews to go back and look at the press releases from the time to see what they say about, you know, the expectations for Dave Lewis on a look-forward basis. And the press release at that time said that your deep experience in text analytics and data science will be valuable as BrainSpace amps up its ability to address increasingly complex litigation, corporate investigations, and government intelligence. Now, focusing for our in-house counsel audience on corporate investigations and complex litigation in particular, there's always this tension of these big data sets and wanting to find what's super important quickly and ultimately be as efficient and effective as you can be in finding what's relevant and responsive and making your production in litigation. So focusing on that, what specific technical improvements have you pioneered over the last 4 years that are now kind of baked into the fabric of BrainSpace, the product that's currently on the market?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I think a big part of my focus, unsurprisingly, has been supervised machine learning, that is teaching the computer by example. And, you know, I think the big first mission that I took on was what eventually led to CAML. And that's to get away from the notion that supervised learning is this very heavyweight process. I think, you know, that the TAR 1.0 models were modeled on a traditional manual review where you had kind of big batches of documents and it's a almost sort of an industrial assembly line kind of workflow and whatnot. And I had always felt that really supervised learning could be like search. You know, search used to be this scary thing that only like a few librarians and things did. Now everyone uses search. You know, you go to this web page, you type in a few words and whatnot. And, you know, my goal was to try to make supervised learning that easy. And I think we went a very long way to making the use of supervised learning a lot easier. It's probably not quite yet to the point where you can just type a few words into a box. So I've got some ideas about that. But it's supervised learning in BrainSpace 6.0 and forward is fluidly integrated through the entire product. Anywhere you are, anytime you find a document, you can tag it and it becomes a training example if you want that. And as opposed to, okay, now I'm going to create a big control set. Now I'm going to create this big thing. Now I'm going to do supervised learning. Now supervised learning is something you can do just sort of very fluidly as part of whatever your natural workflow would be, whether it's for an investigation, whether it's exploratory and ECA, or as part of kicking off a review process in a more conventional litigation. So that's been, and then in, you know, now with 6.3 that just got released, you know, a big focus there then has been further automation. So in those circumstances where it's not so much a kind of human being intensely involved in the interface, but maybe you really are more traditional litigation and maybe you're coding your documents in Relativity with 50 people and whatnot, well, then sad as it may be, you want Brainspace's interface to disappear and you just want to be doing your thing in Relativity. And so we now have this very sophisticated automation framework where you can turn it on once and do this thing in Relativity and do what you always do in Relativity, and Brainspace is running behind the scenes. You don't see the beautiful UI, but all the algorithms are running. So those are the big theme of my work at Brainspace has been there. But then there's been a ton of back behind the scenes things you never see, improvements, the, you know, efficiency of supervised learning, effectiveness, better active learning, you know, even, you know, mundane stuff like better duplicate detection and appropriate handling of those duplicates statistically, and you know, foreign language things. I go on and on. There's, you know, a lot of it's not is not sort of like very sexy stuff. It's just the routine engineering that keeps a product moving forward. You know, and it's a ton. I mean, I spend a ton of time talking to our clients and reading support tickets and whatnot, and just doing these little incremental advances all the time. And I have a very good team of engineers who does that.
So what I'm hearing on the back end of that answer is of course, you're making the brains of the system work better, more effective, learn better. And then on the front end of the system that would present to the users, you're making supervised learning just more approachable and easier to access and quicker into the data, and that's kind of the focus.
Yep, that's right.
So, you know, and this is always an interesting thing when you're talking about e-discovery technology, because you have back-end capabilities of these programs, and then you have the front-end presentation to the lawyers, right? Mm-hmm. If you were to unpack this for in-house counsel and say, look, if you have 10 minutes to focus on augmented learning, supervised learning, these technical solutions to investigation and production, what would be a few key things that they should really focus on understanding so that they can better evaluate the products that are on the market and the value that they're receiving from them in their corporate investigations and litigation?
Well, so, you know, if I had 10 minutes with the GC, I would give it to one of our salespeople. I wouldn't take those 10 minutes myself. But if for some reason it was me, then, you know, the first thing I would ask is, okay, you know, what's your portfolio of, you know, litigation versus investigation? What aspects of that process are you doing in-house versus what aspects of it are you doing through a third-party provider? And then I'd say, okay, now what's your cost structure here? What's the expensive part of this? Because in some circumstances, their data, their needs may be such so that they want to be doing a bunch of upfront ECA, and they have pretty clear criteria on which to do that. And they may then say, you know, for whatever reason, we're going to put eyes on every document that makes it through ECA. And say, okay, how do we get that down to a really small group of documents? You know, and then we're focusing on, okay, you know, we're going to save you money by building models that prioritize things. And, you know, let's talk about what your cost strategy is for the personnel who are training those models, and can they be reused between products and things like that. In other circumstances, it may be we're doing, you know, 200 HR investigations a year, and each one of them is on one person's data. And, you know, we get a kind of vague complaint on a phone tip line, and we just need to dive in there and we need to explore really quickly. We want to look at things on the cluster wheel, say, to get an overall sense, identify these hot areas. Maybe again, we've brought in some standard classifiers we've built for, you know, fraud or sexual harassment or things like that. We're going to run those. But yeah, it's understanding, you know, what are the big costs? What are the things that get repeated many times per year or many times per project? And, you know, how do you start squeezing out the cost? That's kind of what it's about.
After you've done that analysis, you've looked at the case types, you've evaluated the data and the volumes of data against the case types and kind of what the purpose of that project is, and then looked at the resource availability. At that point, how does an in-house counsel evaluate the tools that are on the market to attack that particular set of issues. That once you get through that analysis, how do they evaluate what feature sets the tool should have, what augmented learning might work really well? How do they drill into what they should be looking for in a technical solution?
Well, I think the first, I'm probably not actually the right person to ask that question, since I'm not an attorney. My sense is they're gonna put together a team of people, right? I mean, they're gonna need somebody from IT. They're gonna need to the extent in which they've brought these functions in house, they're gonna need the personnel who are involved in either carrying out investigation or carrying out production, things like that. I view these things as really kind of mundane work the checklist kind of approaches, right? Okay, what do people spend time on? How much do they spend time on each of these steps? What are we paying for each of these things? And then say, okay, then you need to have technology experts and you're talking to vendors. You probably are bringing in somebody else to help you too, potentially, consultant or whatnot. And then you begin to ask really, really tough questions about, how do I optimize this? What practically can I do? What realistically, how much can this time be shrunk? How much can this number of documents be shrunk? Can you demonstrate that? And then obviously, you have your own data sets, you maybe run POCs, you talk to other people in the industry about what they've done. What I would encourage them not to do is look at, what's the latest hype that's popping up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or something, whether it's deep neural networks or, whatever, and because there's no magic bullets out there. And in fact, one of the things I enjoy about this space is that it very quickly cures people. There's some classic general, no battle plan survives contact with the enemy. No AI hype survives contact with email data. You have to be really detailed about your engineering, understanding the structure and the format and the craziness that shows up in this type of data. So I'm very big on people spending the time to understand what their data looks like, their data volumes, their data variety, and make sure that, tools can handle that. And just know that this is not about a magic solution that you get. I'm an artificial intelligence researcher myself. I publish things and whatnot. I invent new algorithms. But effectiveness, cost savings in this area is about detailed understanding of the messiness of real world data.
So, Dave, e-discovery tools like Brainspace, they all come with feature sets. I noted in my research that you even have a couple of patents on particular technological retrieval capabilities. What are some of the innovative kind of new specific technologies that you see coming on the horizon that would be great new features to make e-discovery, faster, better, or cheaper, or just generally easier to manage for in-house counsel? What do you see coming down the pike?
Yeah, well, I think, one big area there is just different data formats. And many, many people have observed that data from cell phones, data potentially soon from other kinds of devices, wristwatches and things like that, is going to be critical in the future. But I think what email was to the past couple of decades, chat is to the next decade at least, which means that your data is coming in smaller pieces. Your conversation, an email conversation, a long email chain might be 40 messages, a long chat chain might be 400 messages. And if it's in a Slack channel, it might be interspersed with 700 other conversations that went on during those same 6 months, right? I mean, there's a much greater role. One, there's simply the issue of this, it's a new kind of format to input. It demands new UI approaches. Navigating chat is much more complicated. And it demands different analytics approaches. It demands, from the natural language processing standpoint, you know, there's more room for what's called discourse analysis in natural language processing, which is how do you understand how does a machine understand the structure of a conversation? And then I think expanding on that theme, I think we're going to see a lot more interest in cross-modal data, particularly in investigations, where somebody's going to want to be able to, you know, in the long run, we're going to want to be able to take chat, we're going to want to take, you know, location logs from a smart batch or, you know, your COVID tracker or whatever, and, you know, phone logs and things. And so I expect to see more demand both on the data formatting side in terms of co-registering things temporally and geographically, and then also to more demand for sort of just tracking linguistically, you know, Bob 123 over here is the same as Robert Jones here is the same as, you know, the blue icon on this video display or something. Yeah, I think, you know, this probably the story of the next decade or so is one, these kind of short messages, and two, then this integration across formats. You know, and then, you know, I think the things that are less predictable are, you know, how much do all the tools that get used in investigations begin to come together? Obviously, you know, accountants have an entire different range of technologies and tools and things. And that goes on largely separately from the folks who are, say, looking at email. You know, to what extent is that sort of stuff going to converge? And, you know, that gets sort of much more into speculative areas. And it's both a technical question and the sort of structure of business and sales and things like that. So these are very hard, but something to keep an eye open for.
Dave, you used the term cross-modal in there. And do I understand that to be taking, say, an instant message stream from pick your tool link, mm-hmm. and correlating that over to an email string, correlating that over to text messages from a cell phone, and correlating that over to maybe a watch, and the machine learning the correlation between those different strings and being able to correlate the different kinds of strings? Is that cross-modal?
Yeah, so that's the vision, because, you know, if you think about in your own life, it's very common that, you know, you'll be talking to somebody at the office back when we used to go to offices. And then, you know, you're on the L on the way home, and I grew up in Chicago, so I say the L. And you know, you send a text message to somebody, say, hey, you know, we should get on Zoom when we get home, and because there's this point to follow up. And then you get home and, you know, you get on your private Zoom and you send a message from your private Gmail account because you know, maybe this is something you're talking about that's not related to your business. And then after the fact in an investigation, if all of this was, you know, a fraudulent undertaking or something, or they're trying to figure out if it was a fraudulent undertaking, well, then they're trying to piece all these things back together and realize that your conversation was spread out over 8 hours and 4 different channels, but it really was all kind of the same thing. So I think, you know, that's certainly a direction that you know, we and others are thinking of taking these kinds of tools, because, you know, that's, you know, what investigators are trying to do. You know, if you think about the, you know, even on police dramas on TV or something, and they're putting up all the pictures and drawing the links between them and saying this person was this point on the timeline and things like that.
So, Dave, one of the things that we often hear talked about is, you know, on the EDRM, the left side of the EDRM, you know, the information governance aspects of information that's living within the corporate environment. And I've always been a believer that we should be looking at ways to take what we learn in e-discovery and apply it backwards to the extent possible to learn about the company, to learn about, you know, maybe be more proactive with the data. Given your kind of posture of brain space within AppGate, what are some of the ways that technology around text classification with brain space, or just in general, can be used more proactively by in-house legal departments to maybe solve some real business problems, compliance issues, things like that? Like, how can text categorization kind of go upstream from e-discovery into the repositories at rest within the organization?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, we've certainly you know, had discussions in that area, and I know we've at least have some POCs that have been going on in that area. It's interesting. I mean, you know, if you think about the, you know, the life cycle from document creation to destruction, you know, we've traditionally in e-discovery and investigation, you know, been interacting with documents during their kind of like their active life or maybe a little toward the end of their active life. And then some of, you know, one phase of compliance then is sort of figure out, okay, when do you delete things and whatnot? There certainly have been, you know, many people often looked at text classification for those. You know, it's, I think it's always challenging in that in the abstract, it seems like, oh, well, you know, we have a retention schedule. It categorizes these 47 types of documents, and all we need to build is 47 classifiers for those types of documents, and we'll know how long to keep each document. And it never works out that easily because the categories were never defined that objectively, and nobody ever did a blind agreement test to see whether people could agree what category a document goes into. But there's certainly been many efforts of that sort, and you know, with some degree of success. I think that enterprises seem to always find it harder to discard the documents than they sometimes think they will when they go into these projects. So it's challenging, but you know, there's constant cost pressure. There's constant litigation danger from keeping things you don't need. And I think we'll probably see an eternal struggle between that and then the data mining perspective, which is like keep everything because who knows what sort of wonderful things we'll exploit from it later. And, you know, hopefully what we'll do is we'll get better at least at identifying objective junk that really is not helping us.
So look at it as a project to call out what you don't need as opposed to determine what you need to keep.
I think it's often easier to, and this is even true when, say, people are using like the cluster wheel and Brainspace in an investigation or something, or using CMML, is it's often useful to identify certain categories of junk. You know, like there's just this 10% of the stuff is just objectively useless. And we can identify it relatively easily through because it clusters together or because we build a supervised learning model or even because we do a metadata search or something. And then it's just an unambiguous win, right? You know, we can get, you know, now we have 10% less data and everything's 10% easier. And I think a lot of the, you know, information governance, I think some of the more successful projects have had more modest objectives like that, not sort of get everything categorized with respect to the retention schedule, but just let's get rid of 10% of objective junk. And if you've got 5,000 terabytes of stuff, you've all of a sudden saved a lot of money.
You used a term in there that I'd like you to unpack for our audience who may not be as familiar with Brainspace. You used the term cluster wheel, which of course is one of the very famous things that it's been in the product, you know, from the very beginning, but kind of just describe that for our listeners so that everybody kind of has a concept of what you're talking about there.
Yeah, sorry. So I should have been ready to show a picture of that. I mean, if you look at any Brainspace literature website or something, you'll see a big colored wheel, right? And it's essentially a highly navigable visual display of what somebody in machine learning would call a hierarchical clustering, which just means that in the center of the wheel, you have broad groups of related documents. And as you go farther out, each of those groups splits and then they split farther. And you're getting narrower and narrower groups of documents by meaning. And it's a hierarchical clustering is actually very, very old machine learning technology. I think that the thing that's compelling in Brainspace is, with a lot of things, the navigability, your ability to visually move very, very quickly, narrow down. You can do searches to highlight what parts of that wheel that you should go to, save things out into notebooks and whatnot. So the power there is in the UX. And this is why I went to Brainspace, was that the commitment to that connection between the powerful UX design, user experience design, and the underlying algorithms.
Dave, one of the things that has been talked about in the e-discovery community for many, many years is that concept of reusing work product case over case. You know, whether it be the ability to locate quickly and efficiently things that are privileged that have already been looked at in a previous matter, for instance, on a custodian that may be a repeat or a communication that may be a repeat, or leveraging the learning from one matter in a portfolio against maybe new custodians. And, you know, we as outside counsel, we're always looking at ways to leverage that work product and enhance the value to clients. And I know that that BrainSpace has really worked to systematize some of that. So could you unpack a little bit about your current product offering in that concept of reusing work product from one matter to another matter, as well as kind of give us a sense of your overall longer-term strategy around that play of how you're making that easy and how you're making that approachable for the lawyers that are doing the work?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the areas that I'm most interested in. So in 6.1, a couple of years ago, we rolled out portable learning, where you can train a classifier on one matter and then one data set and then move it to another data set. Another piece of that is you can build classifiers by hand, which really is simple as like taking your list of keywords and throwing it into a spreadsheet and feeding that in to kick off learning. And then you can go the other way around. You can then export the model out and reuse it and edit it by hand and move it to another project. So this is an area that, you know, we've made substantial progress in. And it's actually an area which I personally have continued to focus on even since that release and working actually with research students in universities and whatnot. We published papers on it. It's an area that and where we're continuing to do further work in that. I find it a very exciting area because it connects with areas that have only recently risen to prominence in the machine learning research community on interpretability. There's been a lot of concern about bias. You know, that one of the wonderful things about machine learning is you sort of feed in this data and it just builds this thing and you can put it into operation. And one of the terrible things about machine learning is you can just feed in this data and you can put this thing into operation. And so you know, they found, you know, and there's been a variety of notorious examples in the media where people have fed in data and you learn a sexist resume classifier or a racist sentencing machine or things like that. And so, you know, one of the big ways to fight that, and I think the thing that's important to realize, and the research has shown this, is you don't have to have malice for this to happen. I mean, it'll essentially happen unless you do a lot to stop it from happening. And the big thing you can do to stop that from happening is interpretability, that you need to be able to look at models, know why they're making predictions. And so a big focus of our effort in machine learning on the next release is even more interpretability, making the models simpler to understand, giving the user more control, more ability to put prior knowledge in, more ability to edit models and have their knowledge influence what the machine learns and to be able to understand that. So I think it's an extremely exciting area, both because of the reuse across cases, but even sort of understanding in the context of a particular project. And, you know, our goal always with augmented intelligence is you want to leverage everything you can from the domain expert, the expert attorney or investigator or whatever, and then, you know, everything you can from machine learning as well. And that's the constant challenge, is to get as much synergy between those as possible.
On June 12th of this year, you actually launched version 6.3,
yeah.
Which my understanding was, amongst other feature sets, that the BrainSpace automated certain of the human tasks associated right. with the machine learning workflows, which is always kind of one of the challenges of moving from the technology into the implementation and workflows. And it sounds like you guys did some work on automating that. If you were to look at, you know, especially from a data science standpoint, you go, okay, what are some of the key things that just aren't getting used enough by lawyers? Like, what would you say? I mean, if you were to say, lawyers, if you were to just start to do one thing different tomorrow, what's something from your standpoint where you go, this just would be a very high return for some investment on the lawyer's part?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and, you know, I'm always hesitant to lecture attorneys on how to do their job. Actually, when I was an expert witness, I actually got I paid the top expert in the country on expert witnesses to to give me several days of training. And so he sort of like beat into me that I stay in my lane and I don't tell lawyers what to do. Like I talk about the science and the law is up to them. But nevertheless, if I had to pick one thing that, and I'll pick an example from the litigation space, right? And this is actually kind of classic TAR 1 sort of stuff. People get really focused on, and partly because we give these beautiful graphics, people get really focused on what would be called machine learning, a learning curve, right? So where you're tracking as you do round after round of training, you're tracking how much the performance of the model is improving, or realistically, how much the estimate of the performance of the model based on a random sample is improving. That's a whole nother issue. Let's say that we really had a real world perfect knowledge of how much the model is improving. People focus intensely on that. And they very rarely, to my surprise, look at how big is the data set, right? Because a 1% improvement in the model is irrelevant if you're only working with 10,000 documents in your data set. And here I'm thinking of a classic TAR 1 kind of call-in review where you're going to identify all the stuff about cutoff and send it to review. Getting 1% better on a 10,000 document data set is irrelevant. Getting 1% better on a 100 million document data set just saved you $200,000, maybe. Okay. And yet the discussions that I seem to get into with attorneys seem to be largely independent of how much the actual cost savings they would get from the performance improvement is. So I think what I would ask people to do is keep their eyes on the dollar signs, not on the learning curve, right? Or multiply the learning curve by the number of documents or something like that. Maybe we need to do better at showing you over time how much money you're saving, not just over time how much is the classifier improving in this way that I would do it for a machine learning research paper or something. So that will be my one piece of general advice to people who, in this case, carrying out TAR 1 reviews.
Putting on your kind of forecast hat and thinking forward, like if we were to flash forward 10 years to 2030, and let's just set aside the things that are going on right now that are changing everything, and just assume that we're dealing with kind of a lawsuit or an investigation, and we've got a mammoth data problem in 2030. You've got data from everywhere, just like you talked about earlier, from these multi sources. Describe to me what the technologies of 2030 might do to help both the investigation side of that case as well as the production and the review and production side of the case. What does it look like in 10 years?
Well, I'm not sure that we shouldn't just ban years that end in zero, but so I do think, though, the kinds of things I was talking about earlier about data integration are going to be central at that point, particularly for investigations, because, you know, an investigation is just going to inevitably be tracking across a bunch of different sources by that point in time. What I would expect to see is that over the next 10 years, there'll be a ton of unglamorous engineering around integration of these multiple data sources, as well as some pretty interesting artificial intelligence. So in natural language processing, there's a kind of core task that people talk about called reference resolution. And that's the one I mentioned earlier, where Bob over here is Bob 123 here, is Robert here, and so on. That is a very non-trivial combination of natural language understanding and reasoning. It involves reasoning about the world and how many people there are and where they were and things like that. So I think there's I think we will see substantially better capabilities for that in 10 years. I'm not one of these people who believes we're going to see artificial general intelligence within my lifetime, certainly. But we'll continue to make incremental useful improvements in these kind of technologies such that, an investigator in 2030, we'll have a great graphic display. It'll show, a kind of timeline of you know, where Bob was at this point in time. This point in time, you know, there'll be, if he wants to look at it graphically, he wants to look at a timeline, and there'll be, you know, he was in this channel communicating with this people, and you know, the in addition to the kind of engineering and the AI components, you know, I think we'll see continued UX design. I mean, we were nowhere near the perfect UX for, you know, easily, because of course, you know, we're multiplying the number of relations, we're multiplying the number of entities. There's just a ton of stuff to get up on the screen. And, you know, I'll be fascinated to see the breakthroughs that get made. I'm somebody who's pretty skeptical about things like, you know, the 3D glasses and immersive technologies and whatnot. I mean, you know, my whole career, I've been going to demos of these things and putting on the glasses and mostly getting dizzy and things like that. Maybe somebody will come up with a kind of Minority Report thing that's, you know, it's floating around you in space and you're moving your hands and things, but maybe or maybe not. I suspect it probably will just look more like a big old monitor that's got, you know, really thoughtfully constructed graphics on it. So that's, I guess that's my vision for 10 years from now. I guess I would say in some ways the negative vision is more important there. It's not going to be like asking the computer on Star Trek, hey, who stole the money? And, you know, by the way, get me the 5 emails that show that they stole the money. You know, it's going to look more like the current world than maybe we might all hope. You know, but with, you know, with substantially better tools and handling substantially harder problems.
Dave, when you were talking about that ability of the technology to correlate, like the way that I would think about that would be, so you and I have this WebEx right now, right? And it's being recorded. And so the WebEx knows who the participants were. They know it was Dave Lewis and Clinton Sanko. So then Clinton gets on his text and he texts Tony and says, hey, I was talking to Dave about his product today. We should definitely give him a call.
Mm-hmm.
And that the correlation would be
right,
that it would
right.
figure out Dave must have been talking about Dave Lewis because I just had a WebEx with him, and the product must be Brainspace because that's the product that we were talking about vis-a-vis this WebEx. Is that a fair kind of?
Yeah, and I would say there have been extraordinary improvements in computer vision and speech recognition in the past 10 years, such that even now, with modern deep learning technology, you get a very good transcript of everything we said out of here. And, you know, you could even start to get a bit of a summary of things like, you know, Dave was in this house with the kind of funny map of Mars and the rockets and science stuff on the shelf behind him. So you would be able to, you know, you'd have somewhere in a database, all that stuff would have been extracted out of the video. I think that degree of analysis or interpretation, which is not the same as understanding. It doesn't really understand, you know, what Mars is or what it means that Dave lives in a house or something, but it will sort of put out, you know, like keywords and things. There was a map in the background. There was a rocket in the background. There were some geology samples in the background. And you know, there was a basket behind Clinton and some books and whatnot. And, you know, if any of those things had turned out to be relevant, you know, that somebody else made measures that mentions, you know, on Slack that, you know, the heroin was in the wicker basket or whatever, you know, then it could cross correlate the fact that, oh, yeah, there was a wicker basket behind Clinton there, you know. Right? So,
right.
So I think that kind of thing will, you know, will be much more in the tools in, say, 2030.
So, Dave, I have a set of 3 questions that I ask all of my guests. Mm-hmm. And the first one is, who is a business leader, and a general business leader that you admire, and what are the particular qualities that you admire about them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a hard one because, of course, I'm a scientist, and sort of all the people that come to mind, you know, tend to be the more technical ones. If I force myself to think of someone that most people would acknowledge as a business leader, I would probably say Henry Ford. Not, you know, obviously there were, you know, things about his politics and whatnot I wouldn't be comfortable with. But the notion of thinking carefully about workflow and bringing to bear what was for the time an unusual degree of, see, I'm really big on crushing problems with technology, like just completely overkill on the problem. And you know, what Henry Ford did was really sort of like overkill on the problem of something that could be done by craftsmen. You know, I mean, essentially, people thought about building things as a process that, you know, one person or two people or something did. And the notion that you turned, and I mean, this sounds in some ways kind of terrible, but you turn this human process into a machine, into an algorithm, right? And it was an algorithm that was executed on hardware that was assembly lines and chains overhead with parts and stuff like that. You know, it was kind of astonishing in its vision there and in the reconceptualization of a human activity, and in some ways sort of terrible too. I admire the vision there, and one would hope, you know, one hopes that we've gotten better about our attention to the human factor there right now. So you know, if you think about the modern version of that that's not gone so well, you've got the of content moderation, say in social media, which is a brutally difficult, emotionally difficult task that people get trauma from, and where there's being attempts made to bring AI technology, say, to bear in a fashion where you're getting the human expertise without the negative emotional impacts that it have on people to carry out that. So hopefully we are getting more thoughtful about these applications. So that goes a bit of a digression off your business leader thing, but then I guess I'm not the usual person you ask that to.
No, it was great. No. So second is, what is the last podcast you listened to, even if it was a guilty pleasure?
I'm a huge fan of Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History, and the new season just started. So I've been listening to that.
All right, and the last one is, what's the last book you read, fiction or nonfiction, okay, that you'd recommend to the listeners just because you couldn't put it down?
Well, I reread Neil Gaiman's American Gods recently, which is sort of one of my all-time favorite novels. And I just, I've tended not to get drawn into sort of like swords and sorcery fantasy. But I really like the sort of setting of the fantastic in the modern setting, and the playing off an American Gods of the modern setting against the old gods, and against even, you know, the transitions in the technological world and what it means for the human spirit and whatnot. So I think Gaiman's a genius, and I just say I read everything he does.
Well, Dave, thanks so much for joining us. I really enjoyed today.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
Thanks for joining us on the Lean Discovery Applied podcast, Season 1, Sitting with the C-Suite. Please rate and review this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe so that you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. You can also visit us online at www.leandiscoveryblog.com, where we have additional content and videos of the interviews. Lean Discovery Applied is hosted by Clinton Sanko, eDiscovery Officer of Baker Donaldson. This program is not intended as an endorsement and does not constitute legal advice. Thanks to Baker Donaldson, a leader in innovative legal services, for supporting this podcast, to the guests, and to you, the listener. See you next time.